This is the podcast for Monday, November 28th, 2011, Ethics. So today we're going to go over moral and political philosophy, or moral and political knowledge. And then on Wednesday, we'll finish up any material we have to do on that, do the student evaluations, and review for the exam. And I think I'll do the student evaluations the first part of class, and then that should take about 15 minutes. And then the rest of the class I hope to devote to reviewing for the exam. Any last comments or questions on Nietzsche? I did a lot more lecturing than I planned to do last time, so I didn't get a chance. I got a few comments from the peanut gallery, but if people have had things they've been itching to say about Nietzsche. So is Nietzsche insane? Is he crazy? Well, there's a fine line between genius and madness. I don't know whoever said that. It's a famous saying. But so on the one hand, you might think, well, he's like a psychopath. On the other hand, you might think, well, if the natural world is all there is, and it's, you know, you look at nature, it's red in tooth and claw, the law of the jungle. If Darwinian evolution is true, it's survival of the fittest. It might make sense that humanity should have a kind of survival of the fittest ethic. And it may be that, you know, as Nietzsche argues, that if, and maybe you could think about Nietzsche's view as kind of an if-then proposition. So if Christian metaphysics is false, then Christian morality is false. So he would say you can't have one without the other. There was some little discussion about this in the forums. So, and you could see, like, you know, as a person of faith, you might say, you know, I think Nietzsche's right about that. He's just wrong about the Christian metaphysics being wrong. In other words, if there really is a God, and God really did design the world, and, you know, God loves us and has a plan for your life in the world, and sent his son to die for you, and so on, then it seems like if all those things are true, that it might be appropriate to love your neighbor as yourself, to live as a servant, to live a life of self-sacrifice, as a way of showing your gratefulness to God who sacrificed his son for you. I mean, all that sort of fits nicely as a kind of a package deal. And what Nietzsche says is that nobody can seriously believe that, you know, in the big man in the sky anymore, or that God became a man and dwelt among us, as it says in the Gospel of John. And once you stop believing that, as most of the European intellectuals at the time had, then a whole bunch of other stuff has to go with it. This concept of human rights. You look at the Declaration of Independence, it says, by the way, our president is fond of misquoting. it says that we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. Achievement, you know, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so the president always leaves out the endowed by our Creator part. I guess he wants to be kind of multicult. He says he's a Christian, but, you know, he's going to this kind of Marxist liberation theology church, which sort of takes God out of religion and replaces it with politics, essentially. And I think what Nietzsche would say would be that. You know, you can't just sort of say, well, we have certain inalienable rights without the endowed by our Creator part. And Nietzsche says, you need to get rid of endowed by our Creator part, the endowed by our Creator part, because there is no Creator. And along with that notion of a Creator goes this idea of absolute rights. The only right is the right of might, or the right of you know, the will to power, the right of a living thing to take what it wants, the right of a Viking to loot, pillage, and plunder. And so I think that's Nietzsche's message. So, you know, you might say, well, you might disagree with his conclusion, but you might agree with his sort of premise. In other words, you might say, yeah, going back to this divine command theory section, Dostoevsky put it this way. He said, if God does not exist, then everything is permitted. And I think that Dostoevsky was a Christian. And he would agree with Nietzsche that if you get rid of God, morality has to go with it. And so that part of Nietzsche's philosophy, I think, is very challenging, and he makes a kind of a good case for that. Any thoughts on that? Yes, sir.
Well, it just seems if there's no way to argue with me, if you accept his presuppositions, once you do that, we have no basis whatsoever to reject anything that is consistent based on his presuppositions. So, one of the big ones is that do you really accept no reasonable person would any longer believe in this sort of thing? Do you agree with how he gets to that presupposition?
Yeah, I suppose there I might say, well, that's like a, you know, that's for like the metaphysics or epistemology class or something. But yeah, so it's, but I mean, that's, that I'll just throw that out that, you know, he doesn't really give any argument against God. He just sort of dismisses God and then says, while we're dismissing God, look at all these logical connections between God and all these other things you believe. So you believe that there's no God, but you still want to hold on to, you know, brotherly love. And what is brotherly love? Well, I mean, brotherly love is the idea that all men are brothers, you know, and that we, yeah, and we're the children, all, we're all children of God, essentially. Yeah.
Well, I don't think we're not getting
a little
shoot holes and all this. This is fine. But I've had blind dreams before, and it's great to just move and gravity, all sorts of things are possible. Okay, it really is fun. Remember. Unfortunately, there's gravity. And so, nature does, I know that's not apples to apples, but that's basically what he does. Just, I'll just do away with this, and then therefore we can do anything we
want. And I mean, you make a, I think you make a good point that, I mean, some people suggest that Nietzsche's living in kind of a fantasy land, that we could get rid of morality at all, that it's kind of, I mean, the other argument you might get from people like Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris or some of these, this sort of wave of new atheism, is that you can be a good moral person and you can prove morality from naturalistic premises. And I suppose that would be something that like Aristotle and Ayn Rand might hold on to. And then you get this kind of middle ground of natural law, the natural law view, which takes this idea that, that ethics is something that's sort of concrete in everyday living, and it gloms it on to, and here's the reason why it works, it's the divine command theory. So, I mean, there's some different permutations here. And actually, while we're talking about this idea of moral nihilism, and one interpretation of Nietzsche is as a moral nihilist, and this goes back to this whole you know, problem with what does it mean to say I don't believe in morality? Because when someone says, well, there's no such thing as morality, well, obviously, you know, people use the words right and wrong. Morality motivates people's behavior. Somebody cuts you off in front of the free, it cuts you off on the road. You call that person a jerk. You blame them for their shoddy driving. If someone doesn't lose their turn signal, you say, you know, and like slows down all of a sudden and then turns without signaling. You think, oh, you idiot! Why don't you signal? I mean, those are all moral judgments, you know, trivial, but they're like the day-to-day moral judgments we make every day. You have a professor that maybe gives you a grade you don't deserve. I think of another example. Okay, you hear about like some, you know, some coach is molesting young boys. And there's, you know, I guess, a couple of cases of this now. And you think, that's horrible. That's an outrage. That person should be punished to the fullest extent of the law. And the people that covered it up should be punished too. And unless you're like a fanatical sports fan and then you riot when the guy's fired. And so, I mean, those people have a moral point of view too. It's just a different one. But, you know, it's driving people's behavior, right? People are angry and they feel it's not fair that he got fired. He didn't do it. All he did was not, you know, report it in the right way or enough or something. And so, you know, moral judgments are a part of our daily lives. And so then the question is, what can you really, you know, get rid of morality and say, well, I'm just going to be a moral skeptic now? Is that really even possible for a person to do? Any thoughts about that? Is this purely theoretical? What would it be like to go the day and like not make any moral judgments or say, oh, it's, morality is just it's not real? It's kind of like saying, this hand in front of my face, it's not real. Yeah.
Do you remember Hicks or one of those plays where they would have screwed up dialogue and people would go backwards out of doors, and all to prove the point, there's this randomness, nothing makes any sense. And the problem is, they sold tickets, they rehearsed, they had a script, they had lighting, the building they held it in had an engineered foundation. Everything about the world said that the rest of it was a bunch of nonsense. And I think if I look at each, you know, or people say there is no morality, that's not where they live.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody I know of has ever, I've ever met in my small world, has ever lived that out. And so I think it's an exercise in their head. But nobody does it. It's not real.
So, yeah.
How would Nietzsche deal with what a divine man theorist might classify as pure evil?
Oh, that's a good question. Let's see. I think Nietzsche might say something like, pure evil is sacrificing your life for a person who's completely and utterly worthless. And so, for example, an evil act for Nietzsche would be a great scientist on the verge of a groundbreaking, earth-shattering discovery, attempting to save a homeless drunk passed out on the railroad tracks and getting run over in the process. That for him would be evil. So it's not necessarily, because he talks about this in Beyond Good and Evil. On the one hand, he says, well, you know, he wants to get us beyond, he wants us to get beyond good and evil in the ordinary senses. But in another sense, he wants to say, he says, what is good? Good is everything which is of life, which feeds the feeling of power that each one of us has inside of us, the will to power, to dominate, to create, to explore, to discover, right? That's what's good. What is bad in life? Everything that repels. So pity, weakness, you know, stupidity. Those are sort of the bad parts. You know, what's good? Knowledge, power, freedom. And so, I mean, he does have a kind of a value system. So it's just that his value system is turned upside down from the one that most people have, which is what's most important while helping people or making a difference. Like, I just got out of my photo class. And so our final project was making a difference. We had to do some, you know, altruistic project where we went out to the community and used our photographic skills to help people, right? So people are taking home pictures of homeless people at like a Thanksgiving dinner for them. I'm trying to remember something. Going down to the Green Hill Animal Shelter to learn how to do first aid on sick animals. And there were a few, I'm trying to think of, there were some that weren't so sort of, you know, things that Nietzsche would really hate. Well, there was like someone that took pictures at like some run, some runner's event. And the instructor seemed kind of flummoxed about it. And she was like, well, how does this really help the community? You know, and it was like basically a bunch of, Ducks fanatics who run up to Mount Pisgah and they're looking for a photographer to take pictures to get more people to run from the University of Oregon to Mount Pisgah to show duck spirit. You know, and I think she thought, to her, that wasn't like enough. You know, that it had to be something that was like this sort of altruistic, like helping the down and out and the downtrodden. There was someone there was somebody that helped with, like, I think it's children's theater or something. But I think that whole idea of, you know, making a difference is a kind of it is a kind of an altruistic, and Nietzsche would probably say, especially Christian idea of trying to make the world better instead of trying to make the world better for people on the bottom instead of trying to make the world better for you. And I saw also Nietzsche might say the race better or humanity better off. So he would say feeding a bunch of street people, isn't making the world a better place. As a matter of fact, it might be making the world a worse place because you're like, you know, enabling some people to survive that the world would be better off without. Yeah.
You
think Buddha may have been like one of the first pioneers of quantum physics, where things only exist if you see them? Maybe he was looking at that, and if you don't see it, it doesn't really exist. Like when I leave this room, it doesn't exist according to quantum physics, and my hand doesn't exist when I close my eyes because I can't see it. So you could be talking about God and emotions and like morality and that. If you just can't see it, it doesn't exist.
You get that like view in David Hume. I think Nietzsche would say that view isn't true because, you know, religious people, you know, have these experiences they take to be of God, but Nietzsche thinks they're deluded. And he thinks there's an objective fact of the matter that people who believe in God are just wrong. So, and I'm kind of skeptical about this idea that an observer determines reality. It's a controversial. Actually, there's a new scientific discovery just recently which calls into question what's called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum theory. The Copenhagen interpretation of Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty. And the long and short of it is it's questioning that idea that reality is observer dependent, or that reality itself is chaotic in its very nature and can't be described. It suggests the problem is really with measurement. I'll see if I can dig that up for email, post it to the forum. A little far afield, I think Nietzsche does have some kind of interesting ideas about the universe. He has this one idea that people debate about called the eternal recurrence, where he suggests this theory that the whole world will sort of end and then begin again, and it'll be the same exact thing, and your life will be, you know, moment for moment exactly the same as it was before. And this happens like in these eternal cycles that last billions of years, that there's creation and destruction, the world starts anew, and everything happens exactly as it did before. And there's a question about whether Nietzsche means it's literally, or whether he means you should sort of make your decisions as if you were going to go through the same thing, you know, eternally. And it's kind of like the idea of not living with any regrets. Nietzsche is more, I think, interested in ethics and morality than physics or metaphysics. Let's talk about generally, like, the idea that that without what a world without morality would be like.
So is this an argument for morality? If there is no absolute morality, then there would be chaos. Therefore, there are some objective, universal moral standards. Or you might say, therefore, morality is absolute. Because there being objective universal moral standards is just the same morality as absolute. So if there is no absolute morality, then there would be chaos, you know, anarchy, people running wild in the streets, killer be killed, Hobbes state of nature. So therefore, there have to be some moral rules, otherwise everything would fall apart. You hear people say this a lot. They'll say, well, if there weren't morality, everything would fall apart, therefore there is morality. So is that the question? Is that a valid argument? What do you think? Without morality, things would be really, really bad. There'd be no order. It would be terrible. So is that proof for there being morality? Yeah.
You you look in animals, pack animals, is there a morality? Or is there dominance and subservience? That would be maybe one place to start.
Yeah, or is this system of dominance and subservience, is that morality?
Is that just the way it works?
I suppose the stickling point here is what we mean by moral standards or what we mean by morality. Let's say morality, a set of you know, moral absolutes which apply to everyone regardless of culture or conscience, and regardless of individual belief, which, you know, are absolutely true and unchanging. Say, torturing babies for fun is wrong. You should, under ordinary circumstances, you shouldn't steal. Now, leave out stealing out a loaf of bread for your starving children or something like that. But just, you know, generally speaking, it's bad to steal and to murder people and to break your promises and so on. And so those that think about that as sort of the basic morality, kind of like, you know, the second half of the Ten Commandments, right? So if you accept that sort of basic morality, then without that, it might be true that the world would sort of go to hell. But then the question is this a proof that there are absolute moral standards? That they exist in some sort of transcendent realm? Or that they're universally valid? Yeah?
I don't think so, necessarily. Because, I don't know, for me, that argument is assuming that we're not taught anything, that nothing's based on experience, really. At least as far as morals go. I think that's wrong.
Okay, so, are you saying that we never get to the point where there'd be no absolute morality? Because it's sort of passed on from generation to generation, the beliefs about morality?
I guess, yeah.
Because, so now assume, like, for in some way, that, you know, a race of aliens wiped our collective consciousness blank, or that a race of aliens took human beings up from the earth and, like, planted them naked, you know, in the jungles of another planet, and they had to start all over again. So there's no idea of morality. You know, how would they live? And so assume, like, some sort of fantastical idea where Lord of the Flies is a good example too, of what happens when you take a bunch of young boys that maybe they've learned a few things, but they're still really young. You plunk them out on an island alone without any adult supervision. They descend into savagery. Let's assume that, like, for the sake of argument, that's the case. So is that a proof that there are absolute moral standards?
No.
Yeah, and then why not? Can you think of, like, a similar argument by analogy, or... Like, it would be really bad if there weren't any morality. You couldn't walk down the street without worrying about being killed or assaulted or something like that. So there has to be morality. But then what do I mean by there has to be morality? Let's try take the heart of the God example again. Let's just replace morality with God, right? If there were no God, then there would be chaos, right? So assume if there were no God, there would be chaos. Therefore, there, you know, is a God. Let's assume, like, if people stop believing God tomorrow, they're like, oh, there's no heaven, there's no hell, my life has no purpose. Therefore, I'm going to go out and, you know, do what I want. I'm going to go, you know, break out the store windows and steal stuff. I'm going to hit my neighbor that I've been trying to love all this time. I'm just going to punch him in the face. Maybe I'll get my gun and I'll shoot him, right? I'm going to, you know, I'm going to have sex with his wife, and then I'm going to go shoot up Coke and rob the 7-Eleven store or whatever, and gorge myself on Twinkies. So you think about, like, all the things you would do if you didn't have to fear, you know, divine retribution. And the question is, well, suppose that's true, that if people stop believing God tomorrow, it'd be sort of anarchy in the streets. Would that prove that there is a God? Well, no, right? It just proves that it's very convenient for people to believe there's a God. So what keeps people, you know, if you think that, you know, belief in God is what keeps people sort of in check from their baser impulses, then it's the actual existence of God isn't what's doing it. It's people believing God exists. Because you'd have the same case if there were no God in there, but everyone believed there was a God. You'd have the same case, right? People say, oh, they're not Shub Cook and rob the 7-Eleven store. God might send me to hell. Or, oh, I should try to love my neighbor as myself because God loves me. Or what have you, right? People are thinking in terms of there's this being there. That being might not exist. So it might be beneficial for people to believe in God, even if there isn't one. And the same thing is the case with morality. This doesn't prove there's some transcendental moral standard of right and wrong out there in the ether, like a Platonic form or something that has independent existence apart from human beings. It just shows that it's really useful for human beings to believe there are some universal rules that apply to everyone and are objectively valid and legitimate, even if it's, you know, a load of BS. Right? Even if it's a social construct, even if the rules are arbitrary, even if the rules come from, you know, evolution or something, or even if they come from human nature, like Hume says, it's our sympathetic nature. So, and this is why I try to explain in the first chapter on moral knowledge, that simply the fact that society would fall apart without morality doesn't prove that there's some sort of transcendent moral truths. It just proves that it's very useful for people to believe there are such things. Questions or comments? Confusion?
Confusion. I look at my own morals and how they serve as kind of a perimeter fence for me in some way, keep me in check within a certain area. But yet there's many instances where I've jumped that fence and violated those morals. And so for me, those are in a sense a form of protection, keep me from doing things that are destructive to me or destructive to somebody else.
Right.
And so I think, well, what if we could eliminate all that sense that there is any morality, whatever the motivation is, how much worse would our society be? Or would it be?
So maybe society, assume society would be really, really bad. Does that prove that those rules are legitimate?
No.
Yeah, so that's the argument. I mean, unless you think about morality as being like some pragmatic rules that help society, then by definition, if nobody believes in the rules that make society better and society is worse thereby, then obviously the rules, you know, had a certain function. But I'm talking about this idea that there's some transcendental notion of right and wrong, that thou shalt not steal is a universal moral principle that applies to everyone, not just some sort of guideline that kind of makes the world go a little smoother.
What?
Yeah.
I would like to think that there is, but if I were a nihilist and would be pushing for everyone, give up your morals because there are none, that's just a fallacy, then, I was going somewhere with that. Something you said triggers it, and I lost it now. But just if we were to all do that, the outcome would just be, I think, just be terrible.
Okay.
And so, there has, in my mind, it seemed like there has to be that objective absolute out there that's saying don't steal.
Okay, is this a valid argument? If everyone believed X was false, the world would suck. Therefore, X is true. I mean, when you put it this way, you're like, oh, it's obviously fallacious.
Right.
Because you get whatever you put in there. It doesn't matter. This is like a fallacious form of arguing. Because the fact that something would lead to bad consequences, it doesn't mean that it's The fact that something leads to good consequences doesn't mean that it's true. The fact that something will lead to bad consequences doesn't mean that it's false. So that's the main point. Yeah, did you have so there are a lot of things. Plato talks about this in the Republic. He talks about the noble lie. And it's the idea that you tell, I'm trying to remember the context of this, I think he says you tell the leaders that they're too good for their position, and that they're sort of, you tell them how great they are, and they're so great that they have to live in like sort of special quarters where they don't get to like enjoy money or luxury or anything, that it's set aside specially for them. And the real reason is sort of to keep corruption out of government. But you tell them it's because they're born under a noble star and they're destined to rule, and that's why you're sort of, you know, segregating them in their own special way when you're really trying to insulate them from corrupting influences. And the you can think of a lot of things like this that might be noble lies, things that people believe that actually sort of might help them get through life even though they're false. I tend to think that, as a philosopher, that believing true things is helpful. But, I mean, can you think of an example of something you could believe something that's false, but it'd be really good for you? Or at least it might lead to good consequences. Okay, well, God, that's the one we've talked about, too. That might be a case, sure. William James actually makes this case, that faith in God is beneficial even if there isn't a God. Pascal, in Pascal's Wager, makes the same case. What about like a non-theological example?
Santa Claus?
Yeah, I guess if you're a kid believing in Santa Claus, maybe it's overall good. It's kind of a harmless fantasy. It might be good.
Well, yeah. That the government can actually do something right?
That might be a harmful belief. Because then you like put your trust in it and give it all your money, and then it screws up again. Well, how about like driving an automobile? You know, the most dangerous thing that you do on a daily basis is driving an automobile. And if you got behind the wheel of an automobile and every time you start up the car you thought 40,000 people die every year in automobile wrecks, it's more, you know, than people, you know, rattle off of the things that might happen, more people that die who are murdered, who are mugged, who, you know, slip in the shower, you just add all the things, dumb things that people die of. And so, like, you're walking, like, you know, late at night in a dark alley, you're like, oh, this is kind of scary, I don't know. But you're driving your car, like, dum, 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 dum. You're like, oh, this is, you know, no big deal, right? But if you're, like, every time you're driving on the freeway, thinking, 40,000 people every year, you know, you're probably going to get in a wreck because you're a nervous wreck. Right? So, that might be... Now, on the other hand, I suppose maybe you drive a little more carefully. But I think just the fact that, you know, maybe you're driving home like late at night, and all these trunks on the road, somebody's going to come around going the wrong way in the freeway, and you're going to be toast. And it's like really, really dangerous to drive a car. But if you couldn't function because you'd be terrified. And maybe this whole idea of like death too, like thinking, oh, well, any day I could die. Or especially when you get older, you wake up in the morning thinking, well, today I might die. You know, that's something that's going to like paralyze you with fear. So, anyway, this is a fallacious argument. Let's talk more about moral knowledge. So where does moral knowledge come from? Well, one of the things that ethicists like to do is talk about ethical intuitions. So modern ethicists say that ethical intuitions is really the way to go, and it says ethical intuitions is sort of the data of morality. And it thinks about ethical intuitions as sort of the data, and then using these hypothetical cases as experiments, controlled experiments. So these are analogous to controlled experiments in science. So in nature, you never have like pure chemicals. There's always some sort of small bit of dilution. So you never get like pure sodium chloride. You never get pure sodium, you never get pure chlorine. You get sort of, it gets mixed in with traces of other things. So if you want to do a scientific study, you want to get, you know, high grade, pure chemicals in order to figure out what causes what. Otherwise you'll get like experimental error. You'll get, like the Russians, they had something where they thought they discovered this new form of water. They're calling it poly water. And it was like regular water, but it was sort of viscous. And it turned out like that some of the experimenters' sweat had like gotten in with the water, and it was like doing weird things under a microscope, you know, under lab conditions. Are like, this is really weird. What is it doing? Why is it doing this? And it turned out it was like just the room was like really hot, and the guys had like sweated into the small little sample that they were looking, performing these really intricate tests with, and it screwed up things. So the idea is in science, you want to create totally unnatural conditions with absolutely pure chemicals, because you want to isolate variables. You want to figure out what causes what. So like if you have some chemicals you're mixing together and you get a reaction the first time, but you don't get a reaction the second time, you want to figure out, well, why didn't it happen the second time? Was it because I didn't use enough of chemical A? Was it because I used too much of chemical B? Was it because the temperature was different? Was it because the pressure was different? Was it because I got my chemicals mixed up? You know, why is it that things, you know, that happen differently? And the idea is that different causes produce different effects. And so you want to figure out what causes what. And the same idea in ethics, it's the idea that you want to isolate variables. You want to think about just one thing at a time. And imagine these cases that would never happen in the real world, but help you hone your ethical intuitions and think clearly about one thing at a time without getting sort of it, having it mixed in with a lot of other things. So, like you're thinking about the concept of justice, you don't want to use, like, as an example, the war of northern aggression, right? Because that's like one way of looking at it, but another person might think about it as being like the war that freed the slaves. So you want to take something that's controversial, and then you don't want to take something that's got a lot of different things mixed in. So you've got states' rights and the Union, you've got the oppression of people by race, you have the territorial disputes, cultural disputes, all stuff going on in there, and you get this really complicated thing. So the idea is, like, think about Nozick's experience machine, for example. So Nozick says, like, imagine you could be hooked up a machine that would give you a completely pleasurable life and nothing else. Would you hook up to it? And you start thinking about it, you think, okay, well, I could have anything I wanted, or anything, any pleasurable experience I wanted, but nothing else. What would be missing?
All and the people, stuff.
What's that?
Just about that all the pleasurable things. You talking about Nozick, where you could set energy mass.
Right. Yeah. What would you say? Other people, most people didn't want to be hooked up to that. How many people would hook up to that device? Just one.
Okay.
So then the rest of you wouldn't. Like, why not?
Because of the things that you have to work for to make life interesting, any of the hard things that you have to work for, you wouldn't have that.
So you think there's no achievement, say, right?
No,
you think achievement
is
valuable.
No.
Right. So there you think, okay, well, if I wouldn't hook up, that means there's more life than pleasure. Yeah.
A lot of times you can learn a lot more about yourself and about how you should react to situations based on your failures more than your successes.
Okay, so learning about yourself. So there's this idea of the experience machine. So it gives you only pleasure, but you might think, but hey, there's, you know, achievement, knowledge, including self-knowledge. What else?
About natural relationships.
Yeah, relationships. You know, you might say true beliefs might be important, like understanding reality. Get in touch with reality.
I guess this go along with knowledge. But being in touch with reality. And there might be some other things that you need to add here. But you think, okay, well, then the idea that only pleasure is intrinsically valuable is false. And so this thought experiment has helped you realize something about the nature of value, that there's more life than pleasure, that there are other things that are valuable apart from pleasure. But you can only get to that place if you're artificially isolating these two things in your mind. Because in real life, these things are all connected, right? You get pleasure from achievement, right? And then if you feel good about achievement, that's going to help you achieve more. And most of the time when you're obtaining knowledge, you get a sense of satisfaction when you learn something. Relationships are typically, if they're good relationships, they're pleasurable, right? So you can think about all these things are sort of intermixed with pleasure, but it's only if you try to imagine this science fiction scenario, which again would never happen in real life, but where you're kind of separating these things, these concepts out in your mind, you're able to say, okay, pleasure alone isn't all there is. That's not what's intrinsically valuable. These other things are too. And that's kind of how modern ethicists think you should approach things. Another example might be like analogies, like Peter Singer's analogies about Bob and his Bugatti or Dora and her TV, right? Those are hypothetical situations, and you sort of argue by analogy, which is, you know, similar to these hypothetical experiments. So you think that you tell a story, analogies, and stories. Again, the idea in your mind to separate out the concepts. So there's like these famous cases with like trolley trains. There's a running right there, like Bob and his Bugatti is one of these examples, right? So Bob can pull the switch leading to the train being diverted to the sidetrack and hitting his Bugatti, or he can do nothing and let it hit the child. And the idea is, you know, what should he do? Now, what are the chances of you being in that situation? Probably pretty slim, right? So, but the idea is that you abstract the general principle that, okay, most people would say Bob is a bad guy if he didn't pull the switch. But then you've got $200,000, in gold bullion sitting in the bank waiting for it to shoot up again with the next economic crisis, right? And you're thinking, well, not using that money to save people who are on the brink of starvation is leading them to die. And so Singer would say, you're just as guilty, you're just as bad as Bob is. So again, the same sort of use of hypothetical examples to try to abstract general principles and then apply them to new cases. So you take the hypothetical example. So you have a hypothetical example. And then, you know, the result of the experiment is you get an abstract principle, and then you can apply it to new cases, new controversial cases. So the hypothetical example, you're trying to get a principle which is really clear, and the idea is that you use the clear to get the principle, and then you apply the principle once you've got it to something that's unclear. So you start on things like torturing babies for fun is wrong, okay? Most people would agree with that. That's the only, almost universal agreement on that. So the question is, why is it wrong? You might think, well, maybe that represents an abstract principle that it's wrong to cause needless pain for your own pleasure. Okay, so now you have like an abstract principle. Because you think about a concrete case of a person who's like torturing a baby with little hot needles or a red hot poker or something like that, just because they're enjoying it and getting sadistic pleasure out of that, you think that person's a monster. Okay, well, what's monstrous about their action? You'd say, well, this is like a really, really, really extreme case of a person taking an innocent person and causing them pain for their own for their own pleasure. And so that idea, it gives you a general principle, and then you might apply those to other cases, right? Like bullfighting, for example, right? You might say, well,
what's the difference between that and taking, you know, an animal, putting a big ring, having some guy wave a red cape to try to get it to charge, and every time the bull charges, he sticks it with like this big metal skewer. And until the bull has enough skewers stuck in his body, it's like a pincushion, it finally dies of blood loss and exhaustion. You know, it seems like a similar thing. You have this sort of defense. I suppose it's not quite defenseless, but if you agree with the principle that it's wrong to cause needless pain, you know, to another being for your own pleasure, then it seems like that case would fit. And she'd say, okay, well, that's what's wrong with bullfighting, is you're torturing an animal for the enjoyment of the spectators. And that would be morally wrong. Yeah?
This is the same thing as being terrible?
Similar, except for, like, Jesus' parables are meant to keep people in the dark. this idea is to sort of try to eliminate things.
Why do you say that?
This might be a little off topic, but Jesus says, to those on the outside, everything is parables, lest they repent. And the idea is that Jesus speaks in parables, or these kind of cryptic sayings, and then he explains what the parables mean afterwards to his followers and disciples and the people that hang around. But he doesn't want the outsiders and the sort of casual passerbyers to get it, to understand.
Well, I mean, it's benefited from avoiding
right. Well, I mean, you think about, like, I'm thinking of the biblical parables. The sort of Aesop's fables might be a good example, though. I mean, this is kind of a technical word. I mean, this is where parables come from. But the parables in the Bible are often misunderstood. But just take like Aesop's fable, right? You can kind of think about that story. You sort of get the moral of the story. So the idea is you try to abstract general principles from things everybody would agree with, and then you can apply those to new cases. And then you try to get general, and this is, you know, what they do for, like, say, if you want to find out, well, why is there something that murder and theft have in common? You might think, well, you know, what do each of those things do, and what do they have in common that makes them wrong? And like a utilitarian might say, well, it leads to unhappiness. Deontologist might say it doesn't respect people as independent persons. And so you can kind of go down the line. But the idea is that you think about these concrete cases. You get an abstract principle from them, and then you've got a principle that doesn't just apply to, like, say, cases involving babies, but you can apply it to, say, bulls, or maybe you apply it to veal calf, right? Should I, you know, these poor little calves that are taken from their mothers when they're really young, and then they're stuffed down in this crate where they can't move around, and they're like, they live in darkness and fill their short lives until you. They're eaten by human beings because they're so juicy and delicious. Again, that's the idea. Okay, what are you doing there? You're causing needless pain to an animal because you want to enjoy the succulent taste of veal. And so that might be like an extrapolation of that principle. So the idea is you take, you know, the clear case, you get a principle from it that you can then apply to the controversial cases. So that's what a lot of ethicists do. And they tend not to think about the sort of grandiose, you know, questions about meta-ethics, but they focus really on, they take into ethical intuitions kind of as sort of as a given, and then they try to make a case based on what most people would say about particular cases and get their principles from that without really asking where the principles come from or where these intuitions come from. They just sort of take them as given. And some people criticize that, and they say, well, this is just, you know, it's what people think, it's culturally determined, it's, you know, it's part of human nature or something, but it's not really getting at these transcendent principles. But this is generally what the modern ethics does, and this is what the kind of the, the move away from kind of grandiose theory building and starting out with a principle to building principles from the bottom up and trying to do ethics in a kind of empirical way, in a scientific way. Let's see. Moral knowledge, in the chapter there, I talk about all the different ways people have tried to justify morality. There's divine command theory. We've talked about the Euthyphro problem. and you know, the idea that you need to, if you're going to accept divine command theory, you ask the question, what's more certain? God exists, or it's wrong to torture babies. And it, you think that most of the time when you're trying to prove something, you try to go from the more clear to prove the less clear, right? So you want to take something that's intuitively true and certain, and then use that to try to chain together with some other clear and certain things, and to deduce something that you're not quite sure about, right? So this kind of goes back to Descartes. So say, you know, 2 and 3 is 5, right? And that's something that I don't have to go through a bunch of steps. I just intuitively see it and it's true. But if I have, like, you know, 24,789 plus 13,166, unless I'm like a, you know, idiot savant in math, or whatever the PC term is it for it now, they can just call them savants. You know, I can't do this all in one step, but I have all these intuitive steps that I already know. 9 and 6 is 15, and I know there's this idea that I can sort of, if I have 15 and I have two numbers here, I can carry the 1. And maybe I have like a bunch, there's a proof of, for why I can carry the 1, but it's something I just learned to do, and if I wanted to go to a math professor, he'd tell me in intricate detail why that I can just take the tens column and carry it over. And then I can go through these steps, you know, and then I can get the result. And so the idea is I follow these intuitive steps, and then I apply them to something more complicated, and I can end up solving more complicated problems. And again, that's a general way that ethicists want to do things. I was talking about divine command theory. And I lapsed back to talking about modern ethics. The useful problem, and oh, you prove the more clear by the less clear. Sorry, you prove the less clear by the more clear. You want
it's clear.
This isn't very clear. You take, when you're trying to prove something, you start out with what you're absolutely certain about. And what you're trying to prove is the thing you're uncertain about, right? You go from the certain to the uncertain. And if you follow a bunch of certain steps, by the time you get to the end, your result is going to be as certain as the step you started out with. That's the way you make a logical argument. So you start out with these certain steps like 9, 6, and 15, and then you end up proving 24,789 and 13,166 and 37,955. And if I'm careful about each of these steps, my complicated result is going to be the same. So the question is God exists? Is that one of those clear intuitive steps, or is that one of those sort of things that people aren't too sure about? And our moral statements, like it's wrong to steal other people's stuff, is that something that's like really clear, or is that something you're not too sure about? And I think that the skeptic of divine command theory would say most people, even if they say they really believe in God, they have their doubts, but nobody doubts that it's wrong to steal other people's stuff, or break their promises, or kill innocent people, or you know, think of all I'd go around generally like acting like a psychopath. They understand that certain things are right and wrong, and they're more certain of that than they are that God exists. Right? Late at night, like, unless you're like raised in a particular faith, you're like, so what? What does it all mean? You know, is there a God? Is there some cosmic purpose? And people like argue, and it's not like, you wouldn't argue about like, I shot my roommate tonight. Is that wrong? You know, you don't think his, you know, his corpse is in the bathtub. I'm thinking about, you know, cutting up with a chainsaw or something, right? And burying the parts in the woods behind my property. You know, should I have done that? You know, if your friends realize you're serious, you're going to call the police or something and you say, you did a bad thing. But when you say, well, I'm not really sure there's a God or not, but it's going to be a different reaction. So the argument against divine command theory is it sort of gets the cart before the horse. It starts out with something like God exists and tries to use it to justify morality when God's existence, and not only God's existence, but what particular religion is true, is very difficult. Now look at all the different, and so you start out with God's existence. Suppose you say, okay, no, everybody's sure God exists. Look at the, 90 some odd people on the planet believe God exists. Okay, well, maybe that's certain. But then what religion is the right one? Because the religions have different moral rules. And then not just what religion, but what, like, interpretation of that religion. So for Christianity, you got Catholicism, you got all these different Protestant denominations, you got the Quakers, and where they belong. You got, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, all these different people, which one? And then don't forget, the Buddhists, the Hindus, and they all have their holy books. So, now I'm not saying that you can't prove which one's the right one, or you can't sort of rule one out, Scientology, forget about it, right? Or you might say that this doesn't make any sense, we'll set this one aside. So we're going to narrow the field. I mean, you might be able to prove which religion has the most going for it. But that's going to be a long, drawn-out process. Whereas saying that certain things are right and wrong, most people accept as being intuitively true. So that's one argument against divine command theory. There's a Humean view that morality is just sort of these feelings that we have, that there's no facts to morality, that it's all based on human nature and our feelings of squeamishness, and it's sort of part of the way we evolved. As our brain makes this association with the sufferings of other people, with our own sufferings. I talk in class about mirror neurons, the fact that when you see something happen to somebody else, your brain kind of does this, well, what if that was me? I better not let that happen to me. And you get this feeling of sympathy, and it's a natural reaction. And maybe that's all there is to morality, according to Hume. According to Hume, that's all there is to morality. And so a problem with Hume's view, though, is it describes morality, but it doesn't really tell you why you should be moral. So it's a form of moral skepticism. So that's kind of dissatisfying. And then people have used various ways to try to prove morality. Some people have suggested that morality is like the laws of physics. This is a suggestion earlier on. It's kind of like gravity or something like that. Or two and two is four. So prove two and two is four. I mean, two and two is four is a basic belief that's not provable by any other supposition. One and one is two or something. Just take your basic arithmetic. How do you prove that? Well, you don't prove it. It's a given. How do you prove a contradiction can't be true? Well, you can't prove it. That's one of the most basic rational axioms, that a contradiction can't be true.
Right? So you're not going to take, A is not equal to not A. Or just take A equals A. A is equivalent to A.
Now prove it. Well, it's self-evidently true. Right? But then you take, wanton murder is wrong. And some people said, well, that's self-evidently true. You could argue that wanton murder is good. Most people would think that's as absurd as saying that a contradiction can be true. So that's one argument, is just to argue that morality is self-evident. And it's similar to the laws of mathematics, and it's something that's just sort of a basic fact of the universe. And it's not something that's provable, but it's not something that needs proof either. So that's another tactic a person could take. And then finally, there's the Aristotelian idea that morality isn't a sort of transcendent set of truths, but it's something that's completely natural, and it's just all those qualities which make you a successful person, a successful human being. And that the things that make you successful as an individual will make a society successful. And so it's not like these sort of Platonic ideals of absolute justice floating out there in the ether. It's, you know, work hard and be ambitious and have courage and do what you say and say what you do, you know, have integrity, live a life of moderation and temperance. All those qualities that which make you a successful person, make people want to be your friend, allow you to survive and thrive and be happy, that's all morality is. It's about living the good life. And that there are certain qualities and behaviors which allow you to live well. There's other qualities which will lead you to dying in the gutter and having everybody hate your guts and leading you to, like, wake up in the middle of the night, you know, beating your breast and wailing, right? And you know, gift on the drugs or, you know, the bottle or you can't live with yourself because you killed a family of five in a drunk driving accident, or you washed out of school because you couldn't discipline yourself to study or do your homework. So, I mean, Aristotle would say that that's the way to screw up your life. And that's not really all the morality is. It's like it's doing the opposite of those things. Of, you know, being a hard worker, having integrity, not doing things that are dangerous and reckless, having temperance and acting rationally. That's all morality is. And that includes, you know, being nice to the people around you, because if you're not nice to them, they're not going to be nice to you. And it's not like you can just go to one person and say, well, I'll never see this guy again, so I'm just going to treat him like dirt. Because people are creatures of habit. And so Aristotle says that if you develop a character where you're kind of vicious to people, that's going to permeate everything you do, and eventually it's going to come back to, you know, bite you in the derriere. And I think that pretty much sums up, like, all the different, you know, ways people try to justify morality, and I guess I'll leave it up to you to sort of decide which is the most going for it. Comments or questions about the basis of morality? Should we move on to politics? Okay, so politics. So some of the stuff I kind of reappears in my philosophy 202 class. One of the things about politics, space here. Political judgments generally are two parts. One is a fundamental moral premise, or premises, and empirical premise, or premises. And one thing I'd like to suggest to you is that you can't do politics pragmatically. You can't do politics in terms of just what works. I hear this all the time. Oh, well, you just think, I just want a guy that understands how things work. You know, I want somebody that people say, I want people to fix the government. I want people to fix the economy. And the idea is it's just got like a mechanical breakdown. You go in there, kind of tinker around with it, and everything will be humming as long as you, like, turn the right gear and get your wrench in there. But no. All politics is value-laden. It's all based on these fundamental moral beliefs. So sometimes you'll get an argument that might focus on one or the other, but you can't get a judgment that something ought to be done unless you have some underlying moral assumptions. And these have to, you know, at the basis, they have to do with the right of government to coerce people and use force on people. It has to do with, you know, notions of what's fair or just. Or, you know, the notion of the common good. So all these things are moral judgments. And so, can we think of about, like, what would be an example of a moral judgment in politics? A sort of underlying moral judgment which affects some political issue. How about America should... Oh, go ahead.
Abortion,
yeah. So, does a fetus have a right to life? Right. That's when you're talking about a right to life, that's a moral question. It's about human rights. Now, some people would say, well, the next question that might come out is like, is the fetus human? So now is that a moral question?
It's a scientific question.
Exactly. And the answer is yes. You know, scientifically, when you get the sperm and egg together, they form that zygote. That's a genetically unique living thing. What kind of living thing is it? It's, you know, it's got the human genetic code, so it's a human living thing. It's a human being. And so, but then come back to the moral question: does a human being in its early state of development have a right to life? Back to the moral question. But sometimes these empirical judgments, they affect people's final decision in the matter. And most of these judgments, again, are like a combination between the two. So like in abortion, the question is about right to life or a woman's right to choose, right? That's also a moral judgment. How about people make arguments, sometimes they'll say, well, if we didn't have abortion on demand, we'd have women dying of botched abortions. Is that the empirical or a moral judgment? I mean, that right there is an empirical judgment. I mean, it's not clear like how many women would go through for illegal abortions and would die of illegal abortions. Now, if you say if one woman dies of an illegal abortion, that's one too many, and that would be a reason to keep abortion safe and legal, then you're back to sort of a moral argument. How about that? Everyone has a right to a living wage. Is that moral or empirical?
Empirical.
Oh, no. It's not empirical, sorry. Everyone has a right to a living wage. Anytime you hear the word right, it's moral, right? It's not empirical. Empirical means from the senses. It's something you can observe directly. You can't observe a right, right? Like, if I say, I have my rights, you say, well, where are they? You know, like in your pocket there? Yeah, well, show them to me, right? So I can't show you my rights. But if I say, I don't know what. Yeah, if I say I have a right to own a gun or something like that, I know that's kind of a legal right. If I say I have a moral right to self-defense, then that's a moral claim. If I say arming the faculty of lame community cause would lead to a safer campus, that would be an empirical claim. Probably false, right? Because that's something you could test, right? You could hypothetically arm the faculty and see, how many faculty members shot themselves in the foot, shot students in their offices, shot fellow faculty members, and so on, versus how many thwarted criminal acts or acts of violence. Okay, how about this? The minimum wage causes inflation and unemployment. So is that empirical or moral claim?
Empirical,
right? It's about economics. So sometimes these arguments have a large empirical component, but then a person might say, so you have maybe a clash between, okay, everyone has a right to a living wage, might be one claim. The other claim might be, but a minimum wage causes unemployment and inflation, right? So then you get these dueling claims and you get more arguments on either side.
Going to war, would that be moral or empirical?
Yes, so one, like, the idea of, okay, the claim, we went to war in Iraq under false pretenses due to trumped up charges of weapons of mass destruction. That claim, was that moral or empirical? Empirical, right? I say false. You should read up on it, because it's just basically an intelligence failure. And Saddam was trying to bluff everyone to think he had these weapons, and that's why he's playing this shell game. And basically, he thought that if we thought he had the weapons that we wouldn't invade. When it turned out, we invaded because we thought he had the weapons. But that's an empirical claim, right? And how do you figure that out? Well, you look at the evidence, you look at satellite photos, you read the Senate intelligence report, you talk to like people in Saddam's organization to see if they thought they had weapons of mass destruction. You talk to like intelligence agencies of other countries that didn't want us to invade and saw that they thought Saddam had the weapons and so on. So you make an empirical case. You know, you're not talking about what's right and wrong and good and evil and so on. If you say, you know, the war in Iraq was immoral because it led to the deaths of you know, thousands of civilians or something, that would be a moral claim. So, you know, just be aware of, like, when you hear political arguments, you think about, okay, what, is this a moral claim or is it an empirical claim? Is this something I can verify or is this something that goes along with kind of a common moral belief that, that makes sense? We're coming to the end here. Is there anything else I want to leave you with? I might have a couple of things I want to talk about. Just the very beginning of class on political judgments, and then we'll do the evaluation, and then review for the final. So I hope you all come back. I'll be going over each and every question on the exam, and you'll be able to ask questions as well, or on the study guide, which will be questions on the exam. And so it's the next session is very important. Also, student evaluations are important. Gives you feedback in class. And so I'll see you all on Wednesday.